I have taken another journey into the realms of AI-driven development and turned my MVP Rust application into a final product.
Are we talking to Martin or is this the AI talking?
It is actually me.
Okay.
That was maybe a little bit artificial in terms of an introduction. But no, it is me. Hello, it's me.
If it were talking to the AI, he'd be talking with your voice. Maybe more on that in another show.
Maybe, quite possibly. So in episode 16, we talked about using ChatGPT to scaffold like an MVP application.
I think you mean Chatty Jeeps.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize to the internet. I was wrong. Let me start that again. In episode 16, I discussed using Chatty Jeeps to create a prototype application using Rust, a language I don't know, and its purpose was quite simple, which was to download things from archive.org. And the things I was interested in downloading were some magazines from the 1980s, or scans of, and some read-only memory. And we left that conversation with a couple of problems, which was we'd found some limitations of using Chatty Jeeps to do programming, or at least in one conversation. It couldn't hold enough reference information, and it struggled with the changing landscape of libraries over time and how to sort of articulate how to do things in, you know, newer versions of libraries that are current now.
I think that's not dissimilar to how it would be if you were chatting to another human and expecting them to balance all the source code in their head while they're talking to you.
Yeah, it's reasonable. I mean, certainly if you go to school or university, you're not learning what's on the internet today. You're learning sort of from a reference snapshot that was taken some time ago.
Right.
But I wasn't satisfied with that initial program. In fact, in those show notes, we don't link to the project because it really wasn't fit for purpose. one of the biggest problems being is that although it was capable of downloading files from archive.org, it read the entirety of the file into memory before it flushed it out to disk.
Uh-oh.
And Alan found that out the hard way when he was downloading scans of magazines that were 31 gigabytes in size.
Yes.
So I wanted to try and finish this program and see if it was possible to use these tools to actually create a real finished thing. And I think I've got there. So as of today, IA Get is what I would consider a finished project, and it's got all the features you'd expect in a robust, reliable file downloader. So it will resume partial downloads and it will check the hashes of the files it's downloaded. In my opinion, it has a very pretty client user interface with emojis and, in air quotes, graphics, and it looks like a contemporary command line application. And it does the job it was designed to do very well. And yet I get to this point with still having not actually written a single line of code.
And so you're not doing this with Chatty Jeeps, you're doing it with something else. How are you doing it?
So I am using Chatty Jeeps a little bit, and I'll get back to that later, but I did make a switch. I found a tool called Unfold AI, and that is an integration with OpenAI that embeds itself in Visual Studio Code, mm-hmm. or I imagine Codeium would work as well. So it's another extension that you can add, and it sort of embeds a Chatty Jeeps-like interface into your IDE, but it is purpose-built for doing coding. It has a number of baked-in functions, which are kind of useful. You can ask it, for example, to write test cases for the code that you're working on, or highlight some code and ask it to optimize that code, and it will give you refactored versions. Wow. Or maybe comment your code. So it will add actually useful comments to code. And the one that I really liked was explaining unfamiliar code. These are all really useful aids, particularly when you're working with unfamiliar languages.
Wow.
How do you find it in terms of generating comments? Because I've been playing with a similar tool at work. I use PHP Storm as my IDE, which is published by JetBrains, and they mm-hmm. have recently launched their own AI assistant plugin for their IDEs. And I've tried to get it to generate some comments for me, and I found they were kind of generic guesses that didn't really explain what was going on very well.
So I think the comments that this generates are generally good.
Is that fair for you to be the judge of that, given you don't know Rust?
Well, I know what the program is intended to do, right? And I know what I asked it to create.
That's the point, really, isn't it? Is that it's easy for it to look at the code and say, this is going to create a variable and do this with it. But yeah, conceptually, what is the program doing is what you really want the comment to be telling you.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is this entire function as a whole doing?
Yeah.
Right. Now, as it happens, by and large, the thing that I use for commenting my code now is GitHub Copilot. GitHub Copilot is very, very good at coming up with accurate, concise comments, either to start a little bit of AI-generated code or to go back and comment code. You start typing the comment and it gets the correct meaning of the code that follows and is very good. So I would say I'm unsure about how good this is because it's not the principal tool I use for automating code commenting. GitHub Copilot's the tool I use for that.
Is it fair to say the best judge of whether the comments are any good is the next contributor who comes along? If they're able to read the code, you might find a proper bona fide Rust developer might say, well, that's okay. But if someone can come along and read the comments and contribute a fix or add a feature and it be consistent with the rest of the code and functionally work, that would probably be a success, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. And we will have to wait and see because so far there's only been one external contribution to the project. And that was from a colleague of mine that improved the little Nix project that's bundled with it to automatically create a runner for it.
Sounds like you're asking for people to contribute now, doesn't it?
I would like, actually, and better yet, I would like people to contribute with AI-generated contributions. I think that would be sort in keeping with the sort of the origins of the project.
Keep the party going, yes.
Yeah. So Unfold AI has been very good. What I found was is that using that, I was able to highlight sections of code in the IDE and then ask a question to say that I wanted to transform that bit of code to add additional capability. And it was very good at sort of expanding what I had and adding the feature that I wanted. So I'd say there's like 20 new features, let's call them, in the program in order to finish it. And each of those was done through a round of highlighting a fragment of code and asking it to add something. So for example, I wanted progress bars as it downloaded the files, and it didn't just make a progress bar. It made a progress bar with estimated time of arrival, the download rate, how long it had been running for, and a whole bunch of visual sugar. It was pretty amazing. And all I had to do was then tinker with it to sort of, you know, customize its visual look to how I wanted it to be. And that was kind of amazing because I don't even know how I would have tackled that in a language that I'm familiar with. And traditionally, what I would have done is I'd have gone to Stack Overflow and sort of searched around for how do I make a progress bar in insert name of language.
Many years ago, I wrote a progress bar for a DBase 3 application. I wrote a blog post about it a few months ago. And the actual application was, you know, 10%. And the other 90% was me writing this progress bar and making it look pretty. So, yeah, right. I could certainly relate to these kind of visual sugar things being quite time consuming.
That's an interesting point that you're making there. And this was like one of the things that I learned. So I'll touch on this now because it's a good time to talk about it. And what I've found is by using these AI assistants to work on code, I have a lower threshold of reluctance now to tackle implementing new features because I don't feel like the burden is high on me in order to go away and learn how to do a thing in order to implement a feature. So I'm more sort of primed to just tackle a little bit of gold plating and polish in the programs because I've got this friend that's sitting there that's going to do sort of the heavy lifting for me.
It's interesting that it changes your own perception of you starting a new feature.
Mm.
I wonder how the AI feels.
Well, I always say thank you and I congratulate it when it does a good job. And it seems to respond well to that gentle praise and encouragement.
Great.
So what I found using Unfold AI in this way of highlighting code fragments and working in fragments, it kind of overcame this issue where having a single Chatty Jeeps conversation, trying to keep the whole reference of the program in scope, where it lost the plot. Working on code fragments, I was able to break that sort of limitation and iterate and expand the capability of the program. And what's interesting is Unfold AI is slow. And by slow, I mean it has a good hard think like Winnie the Pooh. So you sort of ask it these questions. And unlike ChatGPT, it doesn't come back immediately. It sort of has a bit of a churn and a think before it presents its answers. And the big thing is that it doesn't do it by default, but when it encounters these issues where it presents a solution using an old library reference, you can tell it that doesn't work. And it seems to go away and somehow has a think and comes back with a, oh, I've given you a reference to an older version of this library. In the newer version, it's done this way, and this is what you need to do now. And it was very good at making that adjustment to sort of newer libraries and modules, which I was kind of impressed with.
An unkind person might suggest that there's a Mechanical Turk in Mumbai or Malaysia who's actually doing this for you, and that's why it's taking so long. It's not actually over,
maybe. Who knows? So some things that I learned is that Unfold AI in the current iteration, you actually hook it up to OpenAI, effectively like their API playground. So you have to fund your OpenAI account. I didn't had no idea what this was going to cost going into it. So I put $10 on my account and it has burned 28 cents in the wow. queries that I fired at it, which I feel is quite a good return on investment, because I don't know how many hundreds of queries I've shoved at this thing, and some of them are unrelated to this project. So I feel like that's a fair trade-off.
A Rust developer wouldn't get out of bed for 28 cents.
Right. Yeah, you're not going to find a consultant to do that hours of work for 28 cents, that's for sure. And I think it's made me a better ChattyJeeps prompt engineer as well. So I've actually learned how to use ChatGPT better. And I was sat in the back of the car and I was able to get ChattyJeeps to prefabricate a whole bunch of solutions for me whilst I was sat in the car waiting. And then when I got home, I was able to cut and paste those bits of code out and drop those into the program and get that going. So it's a full thing. We'll have a link to IAGet in the show notes. You can try it out. One of the things that's rather nice about it, it's available for everything. It's available for Mac, Windows, and Linux. Binaries and packages are available. It's all in the GitHub repo. And I think it's a pretty robust bit of code. And next, I'm going to be trying to tackle looking at I've got one deprecated Rust crate in the project, and I want to see if it can help uplift me out of that sort of tech debt. And then the next thing I'm really interested in is, can this technique be transferred to contributing to projects where it's using unfamiliar languages and code bases?
I am actually using Nextcloud now.
Welcome to the club.
I know.
Have you bounced off it a couple of times?
I have tried it a couple of times, yeah. I talked about this a while back in a blog post where I talked about my Nextcloud box, where it had Nextcloud on it, and I just didn't really use it. I used it for photo syncing, but it was just a bit underpowered, and I didn't... Every employer that I've had over the years has had something else, mostly cloud-based stuff with Google Docs or something like that, and so I've not really been fully immersed in the Nextcloud usage until now. And the trigger for that is I got a new job.
Congratulations.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm open source communications and compliance lead at orcro.co.uk. But more on that another time, I think, because I just want to talk about Nextcloud, really. Anyway, as I was saying, at this new job, we use Nextcloud, which predates me arriving because I've only just started there a couple of weeks ago and they already had Nextcloud. And so I'm the new guy. And part of the onboarding process is get Alan set up on Nextcloud. And I didn't know what that would entail. And I didn't know how it would all work because I haven't touched Nextcloud for ages and I didn't know quite, you know, how it all fitted together. But oh my gosh, it was smooth as silk. It was great. The admin created an account for me and reset my password. And I just got a sign-in email where I just had to go to a web browser, type in a username and password, and I'm in. And then they shared folders with me in the same way that you would in any other cloud, you know, system or office system. They shared folders, and the folders contain loads of documents. And I browsed around in the web page, and I could see lots of spreadsheets, documents, all the kinds of things you need in a normal, modern running business. And then someone mentioned synchronization and their desktop client. And because I haven't needed a desktop client for anything like that before, I've done it all in the browser. I hadn't thought that I would need it, but I installed it anyway so that I've got a local copy, because these spreadsheets are all editable in LibreOffice, and I have LibreOffice installed. So I thought, well, it'll be quite nice to have all the data synchronized down to my computer. So if I want to edit locally, I can do and have it all synchronized back up.
So in the last few jobs, I've been using Google Workspaces, I think it's called now. And there you can do that online, offline synchronization of documents, but you can also do live collaboration, which I always felt was not that great in Nextcloud. So how is it in dealing with sort of live editing of documents and spreadsheets and stuff?
I'm glad you asked that, because initially I just clicked on a spreadsheet that I needed to look at, and it just opened directly in the web page. Now, this, you know, to a lot of people, they're like, yeah, come on, Alan, get with the program. Opening spreadsheets in a web page is nothing magical. But, you know, in Nextcloud, it opened using only Office. And I remembered only Office because we helped them make a snap of it and publish it in the Snap Store. But this runs inside the web page, and it just looks like, you know, LibreOffice or any other Office application inside a web page. And so the short answer to your question is it was seamless. I opened a sheet.
Wow.
I moved my cursor around and I saw the other employee who was in the same sheet at the same time, his little cursor moving around as well. So it was familiar and functional.
Right. Wow. Impressive.
That's actually really interesting, because we also use Nextcloud at work and use it for collaboration, although we found it to be for doing anything sort of serious. If you're trying to do online collaboration, it can be a bit janky, but we're not using only Office. We're using, I think it's called Collabra Online Developer Edition code.
Right.
Which is like a headless LibreOffice on the server and then a web-based front end. So it's interesting to hear that you've actually got it integrated with a different online Office solution.
Don't ask me how.
Yeah.
Like I say, it predates me joining the company, but editing in Anger may be different.
Yeah.
The company is quite small. It's not like we've got 100 people all editing the same report at the same time and all changing formatting and stuff. I wouldn't be surprised if that was a bit more of a struggle. But for the simple couple of people, one person editing a column and another person editing a different column, and, you know, being able to track and someone say, while you're on a call with them say this column and they click on it and it highlights, and so you know what they're talking about, that kind of stuff is just bread and butter, and it seems to work perfectly fine.
And do you use it for any of the other sort of business productivity stuff, like calendaring, contacts, that kind of stuff?
Not yet. We haven't kind of figured that stuff out because the company wasn't big enough to have, you know, multiple calendars.
Yeah.
And so, you know, who would need to know this? I think we might. But yeah, it's certainly something we're looking into, is all the other features that we could potentially use as well. And we're very big on drinking our own champagne and using open source software wherever possible. So it's delightful to be able to use this stuff and try it out in Anger, like you say.
Yeah.
So going back to before I was diverted into the online stuff, talking about syncing, I installed the Nextcloud client on, well, multiple computers, actually. I've tried it on my Mac on Asahi, and I've got it installed there. I've also got it on my ThinkPad running Ubuntu, and I have also got it on something else. I think this Windows computer desktop that's lurking around here somewhere. So I've got it on a couple of computers, and you basically sign in and you tick a box to say, that's the folder I want to synchronize, and it just does it. And so I've just left it sitting in the background, and it's in the little title bar at the top of the screen, and just periodically synchronizes stuff. I haven't had it get wedged yet. I drop files in a folder and then they magically appear on the server and somebody else updates a file and they magically appear on my laptop. And it's been pretty seamless. I'm pretty happy with it so far.
One really nice feature it has, which you probably haven't come across yet, is that if you suddenly get a massive folder appear on your server, it won't automatically start syncing that. It will give you a notification and say, you've got a file that's over however many gigabytes. Go here to decide which ones you want to sync. So where we have it at home and we have like big collections of photos and stuff, we don't automatically get them syncing down to every machine. We get to pick which ones we want where, which is quite clever, I think.
Yeah, I like that.
That's a nice way of doing it as well, to ask you based on what it's detected about the size of the thing rather than you have to make a predetermined decision.
I did notice in the initial setup, the synchronization had a tick box for don't sync things bigger than, and then there was a thing where you could fill it. I assume that's the setting.
Yeah.
And I knew I wanted all of it and it was huge. Yeah. So I just went, give me everything. So yeah, everyone's remote, loads of documents, all synchronizing fine. The web UI works fine. I was quite impressed with the Office functionality. And maybe in the future, I will report on whether it's all collapsed and we've lost all the documents or whether everything, you know, still works fine. But so far, my initial, after a couple of weeks of doing this, is pleasantly surprised. I shouldn't be surprised. I'm pleasantly impressed with Nextcloud, and long may it continue.
In a previous segment, we alluded to the fact that I'm a fan of Terry Pratchett's Discworld books. And as other fans of the series might know, and if they haven't, they might be pleased to find out, there's recently been a new release of some audiobooks based on the series. So there were audiobooks originally, when the books were originally being published, there was an abridged series, which was read by Tony Robinson, which was excellent. And there was an unabridged series read by various people, including Nigel Planer.
Mm-hmm.
But they've actually just re-released them with new cast. They've got Peter Serafinowicz doing Death, who's absolutely superb, and Bill Nighy doing the footnotes in the books, who's also very good, and then different people for different sub-series of the overall Discworld series. But I thought that the fact that we've got all of these new audiobooks would give me a chance to talk about how I listen to audiobooks on Linux.
Mm.
Because listening to audiobooks is a bit different to listening to other things, because you've got music apps and you've got podcast apps, but I think audiobooks have a sort of niche in between the two. With music apps, you have often quite a big library of a number of small files, which you want to have catalogued and categorised. This is, of course, if you're like me and you still hoard away all of your files actually on your server or on your computer rather than just streaming them off of Spotify or whatever.
Of course.
And then you might want to make playlists and you might want to randomize them, which are things you don't really want to do with audiobooks. Gets a bit confusing.
Yes.
And on the other side, you have podcasts, which have quite a lot in common with audiobooks. But in a podcast client, you generally subscribe to an RSS feed and you get new ones published and pulled down, and you're managing downloads and expiring old ones and deleting them and things like that, which again, you don't want to do with audiobooks, because generally once you bought one, you want it in your collection forever. Audiobook players fit a nice niche between the two. You want to be able to sort of have a catalogue of the books that you have, but you also want some of the quality of life features that you get from podcast player. Things like being able to control playback speed, being able to skip forward and backward when you miss a bit, and like sleep timers and things like that. Because quite often I listen in bed and I want to just say, I'll play for half an hour. And then if I fall asleep, I know how far back I need to rewind the next day.
I do exactly the same thing. Yes.
So there's a couple of apps I found which are good for this. The first one is on Android and that's called Voice. And the way I use it on my phone is I actually use it in conjunction with Nextcloud. I have a folder on my phone, which is my audiobook folder. And then that's actually part of my Nextcloud directory on my phone. And I sync books a few chapters at a time there, and Voice will actually find the chapters as they arrive, which means I don't have to have several gigabytes of audiobook filling up my phone all the time, which is quite nice.
So I am not an avid audiobook listener. I have listened to a handful over the years, And my audiobook knowledge starts and ends with Audible.
Right.
So when you talk about an application for Android, where are you getting the books from to feed that application?
Well, there's a few places. I mean, historically, I've bought books on CD and ripped them. You actually get like a quite big physical box set of a book on CD. Some publishers do DRM-free audiobooks. Some particular authors do them DRM-free very deliberately. Cory Doctorow is a good example. Mm-hmm. And there's a few other people who do, it mostly seems to be sci-fi authors for some reason, do podcasts where they read their books and you can collect those up as an audiobook series. And similarly, I think I've spoken before about Critical Role, which is a Dungeons & Dragons podcast, but they publish the whole back catalogue, which works well as an audiobook. And then there's the main place I buy my audiobooks from at the moment is Kobo.com, which is similar to Audible. But the reason I do that is because there's a project out there called Kobo DL, I believe, which is a little command line script which can download them and sync them to Nextcloud for me, where I can then sync them to my phone or whatever.
One extra place that I get some audiobooks from is iPlayer. Radio 4 have Book at Bedtime.
Oh, yeah.
And I have a cron job that runs Get iPlayer looking for Book at Bedtime and just downloads them, and it goes onto my Plex server. And so I have a giant folder full of bedtime books.
Oh, that's nice.
Mm.
Yeah. And there's one other app which I wanted to give a shout out to, which I discovered recently, because voice is great if you want to listen on your phone, but sometimes you want to listen on your desktop. And there's a audiobook app called Cozy, which I recently discovered, which is available as a snap. I think the snap was recently contributed by a member of the community, and that has very similar features. Another thing which they do, which is quite audiobook specific, is the cover art. When you get an audiobook, sometimes you get the cover art with it, but they also have a good way of sort of searching and selecting cover art so that you can see that when you're playing, because you want sort of the cover of the book, but in a CD format, which is sometimes a bit funny. So yeah, I'd certainly recommend checking out Cozy if you want to listen to audiobooks on desktop.
Yeah, I had a play with Cozy. Cozy's quite nice. It's quite simple, easy to use.
Yeah.
So you've kind of skirted around Audible a little bit there, and Audible is one of the big players in audiobooks, right?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the books come with DRM. I guess you don't have an Audible account.
I don't. I used to. Back in the dim and distant past, there used to be tools where you could sign into your Audible account and it would DRM the file. But I did actually used to have an Audible account, and then I would play from my phone into another computer running Audacity. And so I do have my old Audible library available to me. But right. Kobo is a similar story, but I have found this handy Python script to deal with that for me.
So just today, knowing that you were going to talk about this, I discovered, I am an Audible subscriber and I listen to books using Audible, and I discovered a graphical desktop application which can sign into your Audible account and download and rip out the DRM from all of your audiobooks. And it's called Libation. And it's been around for a few years. It was originally Windows only, and the developer put it up on GitHub. It's open source, and they've made a Linux port, and I think it works on Mac OS as well. And then I bundled it up and put it in the Snap Store today.
Ah.
So if you go to snapgraph.io/libation, you'll find this wonderful application. And it totally works. You just give it your Amazon username and password. It logs in, shows a list of all your books, and then you can either click through one at a time or just grab them all, and it just downloads them, and you end up with a Libation folder with all your audiobooks in it. It's clever.
Well, I may find that useful in the future.
Yes, you may.